AMU 88.5.
From WAMU 88.5 at American University in Washington, welcome to the Politics Hour, starring Tom Sherwood. I'm Kojo Namdi. Silver Line starts taking passengers this weekend, and Prince George's County approves casino construction at National Harbor, both bold efforts to get Tom Sherwood out of the district more often. He won't drive in Northern Virginia, but he will drive to a casino. Tom Sherwood, he's our resident analyst. He's an NBC4 reporter and a columnist for the current newspapers. Now, you can take the Silver Line into Northern Virginia because driving there, as far as you're concerned, Northern Virginia is an enigma. And now you can drive to National
Harbor. You know, this is what's wrong with the media. They have very hard and heartfelt positions and statements, and they often are just wrong. I will be leaving tomorrow morning, Saturday morning, and driving through the warm roadways of Northern Virginia en route to another state to the west of Virginia. But I will be in Northern Virginia tomorrow.
I know you know your way around Richmond very well because you work there, but Northern Virginia
right.
always seems to cause you a level of, well, depression.
Well, you know, it's just, you know, it's either a left turn or a right turn to the end of the earth over there, and you never get there because there's too many cars. But that's why the Silver Line is such a great deal, and I'm looking forward to seeing it. And I truly am looking forward to someday, if I'm not too old, maybe my casket would do it. We'll take a trip out to Dulles Airport via the Silver Line.
And Tom Sherwood is going to be driving. Would you also be driving to National Harbor to the casino when it's constructed?
Probably not. I actually have lost a lot of interest in casinos ever since they went to computer printouts. When you win, like, the dollar machines and the dollars just pour out like they're never going to stop and make that clattering noise, that's a computer-generated sound now. And I have to tell you, it's not the same.
You lose money, you also lose interest. Also joining us in studio is David Catania. He's an independent candidate for mayor of the District of Columbia. He's an at-large member of the D.C. Council who chairs its Committee on Education. Councilmember Catania, thank you for joining us.
Thank you, Kojo.
If you have comments or questions for David Catania, give us a call at 800-433-8850. You can send email to kojo@wamu.org, a tweet at Kojo Show, or if you go to our website, kojoshow.org, you can ask a question there, you can make a comment there. You can also watch our live video stream of this broadcast at the website at kojoshow.org. This week, President Barack Obama, speaking at a District of Columbia school, asserted his support for statehood in the District of Columbia. It is a position that he has been known to have had in the past, but he hasn't said a great deal about it lately. Coming out and saying it in a public forum seems, Tom Sherwood, like a big deal.
Well, it's a medium-sized deal? No, you know, it's one thing to say it as a casual answer to a question. Yeah, I'm for statehood. Actually, he was saying voting rights. I don't even remember he actually said the word statehood. He was saying...
No, I think it was a response to statehood.
I know it was the statehood, but I remember reading his answer. But anyway, all the statehood advocates were supporting. And that's good if the President of the United States wants to support D.C. statehood. But I would think if I were an advocate, the President mentioning it in response to a casual question is one thing. The President actually holding an event somewhere, doing something within the city limits outside the federal enclave downtown, that would be something suitable that would get national and international coverage. To casually mention it is, to me, a bump along a very long road.
David, I like that analogy. David Catania?
Well, you know, we've had a kind of a mixture of reactions to voting representation in our local democracy lately. You know, positive news from the president on support of statehood, but then we've had, you know, recently members of Congress once again reasserting themselves in district affairs.
We're going to get to Andy Harris very shortly.
And Congressman Micah.
Right.
And Congressman.
You know, and I think, you know, I've been talking about this on the campaign trail, that it's time for us to, you know, extend some self-respect when it comes to standing up for ourselves. I believe we need a path through states in terms of voting representation and statehood. I think we've got a logjam with respect to Congress, and I was pleased to be a part of helping get a resolution in support of voting rights through the New Hampshire House of Representatives this April, the first in 30 years, through my friend Cindy Rosenwald. I think we need a states approach to take the issue to the states and through resolutions and take the battle there. And at the same time, I think we need a local political action committee. Candidly, this is a city that has $100 billion gross domestic product, a lot of people interested in acts of self-respect. And I think, fighting back through the political process is the way we level the playing field.
And but be clear, a political PAC as opposed to the nonprofit like DC Vote, but a political PAC that actually gives money to candidates.
Absolutely. And, and I would welcome the association with DC Vote. I think, what DC Vote is doing is incredible. I think we need to support them with some additional resources. And so they are a C4, and what we need is we need a legitimate, old-fashioned political action committee. And I believe that this city, and has, with the resources we have, we could raise considerable resources on an annual basis, and we can park the money. And when and if a member of Congress decides that they are going to interfere and undermine our local democratic institutions, we respond with our First Amendment rights, and we inform their constituents, and we try to drive them from office.
Well, you support going to the states, but there is a bill in the Congress. Senator Tom Carper of Delaware has a bill on statehood that he introduced last year. House Majority Leader Harry Reid has promised that once that bill is voted out of committee, he'll bring it to the floor, call for a vote on it. Carper said he would have a hearing last fall. Then I thought, reliably informed that the hearing was going to be this coming Monday. Now I hear it's being postponed until September. I think we should invite Senator Carper on the broadcast to join us at some point, because if he waits much longer, there may be no vote at all, or the vote will take place during this lame duck session after the election, which somehow may seem less significant, especially if the Democrats don't win the Senate. But with the president now weighing in, albeit Tom Sherwood characterizing it as a bump in a long road.
He hit the city with a feather duster.
It would seem like now would be an appropriate time to bring the issue to the widespread public notice that a hearing and a vote would get. We'll have to see what happens.
May I just jump in?
Sure.
I think we really have to go beyond these symbolic introductions and do the real heavy lifting of bringing voting representation and statehood to the district.
Wasn't that something that former DC delegate Walter Fauntroy had tried back some time ago?
Well, let me
getting it passed in by states.
Well, we did. There was a movement.
So required 38 states.
Right, and the last state to ratify was Delaware in June of 1984, and it failed to get the requisite 38 votes. I think we had 16 states that ratified
right.
it.
Right.
So there was an effort, but it's time for us to revisit it in a very smart way through the states. I don't believe, and this is not casting aspersion on anyone in Congress, that there's just no incentive for members of Congress to give us statehood, especially regardless of party. When Maryland and Virginia, if we were able to ever tax revenue at its source, it would drain Annapolis and Richmond of hundreds of millions of dollars.
Every year.
It would be transformative, especially for the state of Maryland, which relies disproportionately on these revenues. So there is an institutional interest, regardless of party affiliation, within Congress itself to deprive us of our right to statehood. Therefore, I think the path is through the states, and I think the only self-respecting tool at our disposal, candidly, is fighting against those members who would take our democratic rights away from us.
The argument ought to be to the other 48 states that do you realize that Maryland and Virginia are just making a fortune off of the District of Columbia because they can. Their power and their Senate and their House members, they can continue to draw all the money for people live in the suburbs and work in the city. They draw all these hundreds of millions of dollars every year, and because we don't have the right to tax our own workers.
That may be interesting to the other states, Tom, but I think what's important for us is to get out of Washington, D.C., and to tell our stories in state capitals and to try to reach bipartisanship consensus in state houses around the issue of voting representation.
We could cut taxes in the city if we didn't have to give so much money to Annapolis and Richmond.
Of course we could. And I might say, we were able to get the resolution through the New Hampshire House after three tries in a bipartisan way. I've made three trips to New Hampshire over the last 6 years. The last one was to sit down with both Democrats and Republicans and figure out what it was, what their issues were, and how we could work together to secure bipartisan support. We were successful there. I'm not suggesting it's easy, But it is a more sure-fired path than simply getting serially arrested in our own city on behalf of the issue.
Our guest is David Catania. He's an independent candidate for mayor of the District of Columbia. He's an at-large member of the D.C. Council who chairs its Committee on Education. Tom Sherwood is our resident analyst. He's an NBC4 reporter and a columnist for the current newspapers. Questions or comments, give us a call, 800-433-8850. Want to see this show? Go to our website, kojoshow.org, where you'll see a live video stream, Tom Sherwood.
Is it time now to start asking him questions?
Yes, it is.
I'd like to keep talking about statehood, but since it's
yes,
a long-distance story,
bypass the Andy
Harris
incident because
I do
want to
ask you about this week. There was a couple of quick questions before we get to one of the issues I know we all want to talk about. Let's talk about soccer. There were two public hearings by the Economic Development Committee, having been chaired by Muriel Bowser, on whether we're going to have a soccer stadium built in Southwest Washington within near the baseball stadium. Where are you on that? I wasn't clear. Where do you stand on the mayor's proposal to build a soccer stadium?
Well, I support building a stadium, first and foremost. I don't support the swap with respect to the Reeve Center. I believe that the Reeve Center should be redeveloped. It should be done in a measured, thoughtful way. I don't believe we should sell it and then lease it back for the entire sale price, which is eventually what will happen.
And just for the viewer, the listeners to know and viewers, is that that's the government office building at 14th and U, which
right.
is a dynamic, growing part of the city.
That's right. And so I believe that we could move the Reeve Center and those government offices to another location to spur development in another part of the city, but we need to do that in a measured way. We need to have a plan as to how and when we're going to develop the next site, how we're going to move perhaps right side government offices, et cetera, and what's going to happen on that site, including, commercial and hotel development where there can be day traffic to help support U Street. So I don't think tethering that to the construction of a soccer stadium makes sense.
Can you get to a soccer deal before the end of the year? Before
I would
Mayor
hope so.
Gray leaves office? And
I would hope so.
This will be one of his signature achievements if this gets done. So you think it can get, down? No, you hope so. Do you think
I would hope so. And here's why. I would hope that rather than take the millions that are anticipated from the sale of the Reeve Center for purposes of helping, to construct the stadium. We're sitting on nearly a $2 billion accumulated surplus. We can simply take dollars out of our bank and square the accounts for purposes of building the stadium. What I'd like us to do is focus on building a really good stadium, and that means not only a transportation plan, but a low and moderate income housing plan for the community immediately surrounding the stadium. We need to make this a community project, not just a soccer project, and that's what's missing right now. As far as I know, DHCD and the Housing Finance Agency has really not been at the table with respect to the soccer stadium about what the impact will be on the low and moderate income housing that we have there, and what we certainly don't want to see is the stadium come and displace more low-income residents.
And what about streetcars? I mean, Councilmember Tommy Wells voted against the budget because the current year 15 budget took $400 million out of the planned money for streetcars. And where the stadium is located, I think Bowser herself said she's concerned about it being so far from a metro stop. And will a streetcar be part of the transportation mix, in your opinion?
Well, I think there are ways for us to develop short, medium, and long-term transportation plans until such time as the light rail system is extended. I don't believe this budget was apocalyptic with respect to the streetcars, as Mr. Wells believes. I believe every year budgets can be adjusted and fine-tuned based on what we can spend in a measured, thoughtful way. And, the budget that we passed does continue to fund the light rail to the tune of nearly $500 million. And, and going forward, we can always adjust it to spend more.
Would the Reeve swap in the D.C. Stadium deal be a deal killer for you?
It would be. I don't believe that you sell one of the family jewels based on a negotiation without putting this, prime piece of property out to bid for the highest bidder. And I don't think it's a necessary ingredient from my perspective in building a soccer stadium. If what Mr. Ackridge wants for the property he owns in Southwest is X amount of dollars for that land, we can give him X amount of dollars. We don't have to sell the Reeve Center to come up with the X amount and then give him the Reeve Center where the spread is incredible. And so, it then becomes a negotiation between the district and Ackridge for the purchase of the land in Southwest. And I'm happy to have an arm's length transaction and negotiations for that amount.
And you have the council has hired a consulting firm and willing to spend up to $200,000.
Yeah.
CLS or whatever that national firm is, and Robert Bob, the former city administrator and school board president, is representing that team to study it for the council. but I guess it's probably too early to have any kind of results from them.
Well, we haven't received any results, right. And I look forward to them. And I welcome that. I welcome that process to give us more insights and, you know, and some of the things that we've either thought about or haven't thought about, and to flesh it out further. So I welcome that. But at the end of the day, I do support a soccer stadium, and I think we have the resources to do it. We should be focused on making sure the stadium is a success, and also, you know, making sure there's low and moderate income housing there secured in a transportation plan.
I want to move to education, and I'll let Walter in Washington, D.C. do that for me. Gentlemen, please don your headphones so that you can hear Walter, who is now on the air. Walter, go ahead, please.
Thank you, sir. How are you today?
I am well.
I need to give you some numbers first. Mr. Catania, 45% D.C. students, charter schools, $600 million, Mr. Catania, D.C. money going into charter for-profit schools. Sir, is there time yet? See, you don't know that at 58 years old, I remember when McKinley Tech was, in fact, an icon in the D.C. area.
Okay, but question,
now,
Walter.
They have a for-profit school right next door offering the same services.
Question,
is there,
Walter.
Time, Mr. Catania, in your Republican fraud, to call a moratorium on charter schools, sir?
Is it time? I don't know what the Republican reference is about, right. But is it time to call a moratorium on charter schools?
Well, charters currently represent about 45% of our school-age kids, and it's pursuant to the law that permits the charter schools to open up as many as 10 per year. I think what it's time for, certainly, more coordination between our traditional public school system and our charter school system.
What does coordination mean?
Well, coordination means, you know, with respect to the location and planning of the schools. In other words, the chancellor has, you know, herself voiced concerns about the location of charter schools immediately adjacent to programming that she's trying to establish within the traditional public school system. It means the use of traditional public school buildings that are no longer used for public schools and perhaps making some of them available for charters. I'm really in favor of making sure that we have two fine systems, that we really have one public education system that includes traditional public schools and charter schools, and giving parents the choice to choose among the various local education agencies. My focus has been on improving, candidly, our traditional public schools. And during my year and a half as chairman of the committee, just last month, the council funded a bill I authored last year, the Fair Funding Bill, which puts $80 million into the hands of our schools to help support low-income students and at-risk students to narrow achievement gaps. We've ended social promotion, and we're tackling special education, a whole host of issues, trying to improve our entire public school system. And I'm frankly, you know, not interested in the Hatfields and McCoy fighting between charters and DCPS. I want the whole system to work.
Sherwood.
Well, on education, you've made it a centerpiece of your campaign for mayor. You, I guess in schools, you're not still visiting the schools,
are you? We finished our 144th substantive school last month. My staff has calculated that I've spent an entire 3 months in schools in my first 18 months as chairman of the committee, and it's given me incredible insight to sit across the table from our school leaders and talk about how we set schools and children up to succeed, and it's been an incredibly informative experience.
The Democratic nominee, Muriel Bowser, did not initially, but has since, more recently, said that she would keep Kaya Henderson as the chancellor should she, Bowser, become mayor. You've kind of resisted making appointments until you actually win. But what is your thought about how Kaya Henderson has been doing, whether or not you'll say today she will be staying definitely working for you if you win?
Well, you know, I think the point is clear that the chancellor currently has a boss and we haven't had an election. Contrary to what people may believe, the Democratic primary is not the election. It's a primary. The election happens in November. I think it puts a chancellor in an untenable position to have people, you know, assuming they're going to be, you know, that she's going to be working for them, either Ms. Bowser or me, and then it really results in her trying to please more than one master. She has a master at the moment. She has an employer. It's the mayor. And until there's an election, there isn't a successor. I happen to think that the chancellor has done a number of things very well. I think the focus, for instance, more recently on greater vertical integration of the schools, the greater focus on middle schools, in part with the prodding of the Committee on Education, her willingness to sit down and talk about a new East of the River application in middle school. I mean, her work, you know, trying to fine-tune evaluation systems, whether it be for teachers or principals. I found her to be open on a number of fronts. But as with any working relationship, there are things you agree on, those that you don't. But I'm not critical of the chancellor. I don't think you can find a time where I've made a publicly critical comment about her. But what I think is unfair is to engage in personnel decisions before an election.
You said Ms. Bowser or me. You didn't mention Carol Schwartz, who is also throwing her hat in this race for mayor. Don't you think she has a chance?
Let me include her then as well. I didn't mean to carve anyone out.
Well, speaking of Ms. Bowser, a week ago on this broadcast, we spoke with Muriel Bowser about the situation at Park Southern Apartments, an affordable housing complex in Ward 8 that's in financial trouble and where living conditions have deteriorated. She's called on the Inspector General to find out what happened to city funds. Management of the nonprofit that oversees Park Southern includes supporters of Muriel Bowser. You have said an IG investigation is inadequate. Why?
Well, I think it's political theater. I believe Ms. Bowser has known the state of affairs on that site since May. And nothing happened between the May 8th meeting where she met with members of the executive, where the executive gave her the lawsuit that the tenants had filed the week earlier, where the executive gave her a copy of the condition assessment of the building, where she knew everything that was going on May 8th, and yet resisted until July asking for an inspector general only after the Post report. But what's very
After many stories, right.
But what's important to realize is the timing. Ms. Bowser claims that she has interceded because she's concerned about stability and preserving affordable housing. I think the facts show something quite different. I think Ms. Bowser intervened to help grease the wheels for a sale of that building to Finus Jones and Joyce Scott, two of her most important supporters. And here's basically the timeline. On April 7th, DHCD said that the existing management, Department of Housing and Community Development,
which oversees all the subsidized housing.
And DHCD owns the note on the building, Park Southern. On April 7th, they said, you have 30 days to figure this out, to give us our nearly $700,000, or we're going to assume responsibility, exercise our right as the deed holder over the property. On the day before that ended, on May 6th, Ms. Bowser reaches out through her staff to the head of DHCD, asking Mr. Kelly to meet her on the 8th of May in her office with Finus Jones and with Joyce Scott. Joyce Scott is the resident manager. Finus Jones owns the company that's purchasing or wants to purchase the building. Now, why is that interesting? It's interesting because Ms. Bowser reaches out for the meeting on the exact same day that the board, Ms. Scott's board, approves the sale of the building, the exact same day that a second transaction occurs where the sale actually happens between Ms. Jones and Mr. Jones and Ms. Scott, and the same day that a fake tenant association essentially approves the deal. I mean, everything is happening the day of.
You say a fake tenant association?
Well, there are two tenant associations. There's the one that the courts recognize, and then there's another one. There's the Park Southern Apartments tenant resident council, and then there's the Park Southern Resident Council. And so the resident council, not the apartment resident council, is the one recognized by the court. But a letter is sent on May 6th from the apartment resident council in support of this deal. Now, is this just a convergence of coincidence that everyone decides on the same day that this sale is going to happen and that Ms. Bowser on that day has her staff reach out for a meeting with DHCD and Ms. Scott and Mr. Jones for the 8th of May? Ms. Bowser was so intent that this meeting occur that not only did she have her staff send the email on the 6th of May, but she picked up the phone herself on the 7th of May. On the 7th of May, she asked Mr. Kelly to come the next day to a meeting to her office to include Finus Jones and to include Joyce Scott. And what's really important is the sweetheart nature of the deal that Ms. Scott and Mr. Jones cut for each other. He was going to purchase a $20 million building for the sum total of $3.7 million. That looks like a big number. But the only money on the table was $100,000. He was going to assume the note from DHCD. So what better strategy than to have Ms. Scott and Mr. Jones conspire together to purchase a building, to assume the loan from the head of DHCD, and then Ms. Bowser, who is the oversight chairman of DHCD, and in her mind, the presumptive mayor, call Mr. Kelly in the next day and share with them the deal.
Do you think Bowser was part of this, or do you think Bowser was being manipulated by these owners, Finus Jones and Ms. Scott?
Or do you think, as she says, that she was more interested in getting results than she is in grandstanding?
Well, let's look at the facts. The facts are, on the 8th of May, the Thursday that meeting happened, the executive, The mayor's office, number one, gave Ms. Bowser a copy of the lawsuit, which explained all the tenants' complaints. And mind you, Ms. Bowser never asked for the tenants to be present at that meeting. When you're bringing everyone to the table, one would hope you would bring them to the table. She was presented with the lawsuit. She was presented with a conditions report, which told her how bad the building was. and she never did anything about it. She instead asked for the authority that the Attorney General has to foreclose on the note. She did it again by having her staff on the 3rd of June, never concerned about the tenants. Once again on the 3rd of June, ask for the executive, the mayor's power and authority to foreclose that note. And then coincidentally, 7 days later, more campaign contributions come from Mr. Jones, who himself was the property manager for a period this spring, where $300,000 has yet to be transmitted to the city during his tenure.
Here's the problem I have with this, and I think viewers, people listening, is they can't follow all the details.
Sure.
I know it fairly well now, and I understand the direction of it. But it just in the political sense of this, not making a show, but just the politics of this and talking to the voters who you want to vote for you as opposed to Ms. Bowser, what did she do wrong? Are you saying she favored the corrupt or mismanaged owners of the building over the 700 tenants? Or that she just didn't know what she was doing? What is your basic political complaint without all the details and subparagraphs?
Well, we really don't know because there hasn't been an open hearing in the process, which the mayor's staff.
And you don't think an investigation by the Inspector General will tell us all we need to know?
The Inspector General will not tell us anything for months and months and months and months.
Maybe next year, maybe later.
Right. And we don't have a permanent Inspector General, and the people who work in the Inspector General's office right now are waiting to see who will be the person who will appoint the next Inspector General, and no one wants to be on the wrong side of that.
Do you want to have a public hearing on this?
Absolutely.
Could another government, another committee, if she's the chairman of the Housing Committee and she doesn't want to do it, can another committee hold it to have some of these facts laid out in an intelligent line so we can all understand what's happened or not happened?
Sure. Well, you know, the Committee of the Whole could absolutely have a hearing. The chairman of the council could have a hearing. And that's absolutely possible. But what I'm...
Are you going to ask him to do that?
Absolutely. Absolutely. But here's what's beating away. We have 360 units of affordable housing that are at risk right now. The conditions report, having walked the building myself, I can tell you these issues are real. We have no evidence that anything is really being done on the part of the Committee on Economic Development, which my opponent chairs, to remedy or to address. There's been no reaching out to the resident council, the legitimate one. There's been no tours. There's been no public hearing, no discussion about how we're going to preserve this. And what I fear will happen is the clock will run out and that the purchase will happen and the tenants will wake up and they will be without the building that they themselves currently own.
One of your supporters told me, I was at the Donald Trump Hotel groundbreaking, and one of your supporters there kind of said sneeringly, "Well, Ms. Bowser can make time to come stand with Donald Trump for a luxury hotel, but she won't make time to go to Park Southern." Do you think that's fair?
Well, I think people are entitled to their opinions, but this is the issue. The issue is whether or not Ms. Bowser used her influence to advance the interests of two supporters who are working together to purchase the building that's worth $20 million for $100,000 and to assume the note. And inviting DHCD, the people who would make that decision, to her office the day the deal was done suggests that she perhaps wasn't interested, really, in the tenants, but in advancing the interests of her supporters.
And speaking of the Trump event, you tweeted on that event that you have never been happier not to have been there. Can you explain that?
We should say Trump Hotel, 12th in Pennsylvania.
The old post office building redeveloped by Trump.
Big luxury hotel.
You were not there. And you were happy
and
not
you were
to
invited.
Be there.
I was. There are a lot of reasons being away as to why I wasn't happy, why I didn't feel it necessary to be there. Mr. Trump has a history of some disrespectful statements towards our president. He led the birther movement and continues to, and I didn't see any point in necessarily joining him for a grin fest on Pennsylvania Avenue.
On July 14th, some members of the D.C. Council sent a letter asking concrete construction firm Baker D.C. to respect its workers' right to organize. You were the only member of the council who did not sign that letter or send your own version like Chairman Phil Mendelson did. Can you explain why your signature did not appear on that letter?
Well, I've sent many letters, frankly, on behalf of workers who claim that they were having their rights to organize harassed or frustrated. I actually did that last month with local SEIU Local 500 when employees and adjunct professors at UDC were claiming that the government was frustrating their ability to organize. And so I'll absolutely send a letter when I feel that the National Labor Relations Act is being frustrated through unfair interference. I didn't candidly see the evidence that the construction company at issue was engaging in that behavior. Had that come to my attention, I would have had a different point of view.
Now, let me cut to the chase. A few years ago, you left your position as vice president of corporate strategy as electrical contractor and construction firm MC Dean. Did your history of working in the construction industry affect your decision not to sign the Baker DC letter?
Not at all, because if you look at my record, you'll see I've signed many of these letters, not only to organize, but the right to strike, and in support of striking workers. I met actually this week with the Washington Area Labor Council and went through a record which includes having funded millions of dollars in labor construction or labor training programs, having authored the last minimum wage increase in 2004, having authored the first living wage bill in the city. I have a pretty strong record with respect to workers. This one, in the time I had to review the issue, I didn't see the evidence of management frustrating the rights to workers. In those instances, I try to stay out of it.
The big politics of this, Vincent Orange in the last, in his campaign for mayor or whatever office he was running for at the time, has been critical of people who hold outside jobs, and he's been specifically critical of you for the time that you worked for MC Dean, a major corporation. On this program last week, Muriel Bowser made some, she didn't give a lot of details, some reference to a $70 million audit at the United Medical Center. I don't know if that involved MC Dean or whatever.
Oh, no, absolutely not. That was the United Medical Center.
Okay. I didn't know what that was, but the suggestion is you have...
But may I comment on that?
Yes.
I mean, I think you have the tale of two Southern Avenue addresses. Muriel Bowser is chairman of the Committee on Economic Development. When, 700 residents were in harm's way with respect to their housing, her view was to vacate the field and ask the inspector general to do something. Several years ago, when United Medical Center, the hospital formerly known as Greater Southeast, was on the verge of bankruptcy, I didn't run away from the bomb. I ran towards it. She was asking, what happened to the $70 million? Well, we have a full accounting of what the city did with the $70 million, including building a Children's National Medical Center-run pediatric ER, which sees 40,000 children per year, new radiology, new hyperbaric wound chambers, new dialysis equipment, the first and only MRI east of the Anacostia River, new exterior, new roof, new elevators, etc. The hospital has turned around so much so that this year they expected to make a profit.
I set a reminder on my phone two summers ago to ask you in the summer of 2014 about United Medical Center. How would you assess the health of it? You say it's set to make a profit?
Absolutely. Mr. Smalls, who was on a competing show earlier this week, stated this year they expect to make a profit. Look, turning around safety net hospital.
There is no competing show, but go ahead.
And also GW Hospital has expressed interest in working over there now in addition to Washington Hospital Center.
Exactly. And the notion, though, that, turning around safety net hospitals in the best of times is not easy, but in the middle of the Great Recession is especially hard. And, due in part to the advocacy and the single-mindedness which the committee took to improve that hospital, we've doubled the number of employees. It's the largest employer in Ward 8 with over 1,000 employees. There are over 50,000 adult emergency room visits, which were preserved, over 40,000 children's emergency room visits, which candidly were preserved. And every night when I'm on the campaign stump, I'm talking about that facility as integral to the life and safety of every resident in the city. And you wonder, well, why is that? Because our
last question, Tom.
I want to go back to, because I think we went too fast on MC Dean,
sure.
Major corporation that has contracts for the city.
Yeah.
Can you just say as authoritatively as possible as you can that anyone can look at any
absolutely
anything you've done with MC Dean and that there's no place where you've influenced, promoted, talked about
categorically
any kind of contract between MC Dean? Because if there is, that changes significantly.
Well, Tom, I worked for a subsidiary of the company for many years and then for 2 years for the parent. And during, I think, the 7 years I was with them, I recused myself from all matters involving the company and their contracts with the city. But I want to put the contracts into perspective. These were contracts that the company had with the city prior to my arrival. They represented less than 2%, never more than, a percent and a half of the 800 plus million revenue of the company. The contracts were competitively bid, less than 2%. But more importantly, I was responsible for activities across the company that isn't a D.C. company. You know, this is an international company. May I finish?
I know.
This is a company with 3,000 employees in 35 offices around the world. And among other things, I held a top secret security clearance, you know, issued by the National Industrial Security Program. I went through the most rigorous background check imaginable for purposes of handling classified information. We were an international company that had a few contracts with the city, which I always recused myself from any involvement in, both inside the company and inside the city.
Okay, I
just wanted to tee that up for the rest of the campaign in case something else comes out that you were more involved in MC Dean's local contract than you have said, so that's good.
Perfect.
David Catania, he's an independent candidate for mayor of the District of Columbia. He's an at-large member of the D.C. Council who chairs its Committee on Education. David Catania, thank you for joining us.
Thank you, Coach. Thank you, Tom.
Tom Sherwood is our resident analyst. He's an NBC4 reporter and a columnist for the current newspapers. We're going to be talking shortly with Tom Hucker, who's a Democratic nominee for the Montgomery County Council. If you have questions or comments for him, call us at 800-433-8850. You can send email to kojo@wamu.org. You can go to our website, kojoshow.org, and watch the live video stream of the broadcast. Tom Sherwood, I don't know if you have been reading or hearing about this, but Bethesda in Rockville got named among the 10 snobbiest small cities in America, according to the real estate website Movoto.com. These snooty little cities in Montgomery counties have rich, well-educated, private school-loving art gallery devotees who have the most rigid of standards that must always be met. I would have expected you to be living in Bethesda or Roswell, but strangely enough,
I lived on the edge of Bethesda Chevy Chase once long ago when I was lost in the wilderness. Let me just say, I went to Movoto or whatever it is, and I would say that the website itself seemed to be snobbish and self-important and overtly too cutesy. And so for them, they make their get clicks, I guess, for their website by doing these 10 whatevers. So they call Bethesda and Rockville. Bethesda's number 2 and Rockville's number 8, just to be clear. And it's all based on places that are safe, wealthy, and interesting. I would just say it was kind of a summertime waste of time, like a popsicle that's melting, and we won't care about it 2 days from now, if then.
Our message to them is leave Bethesda and Rockville alone. Tom Hucker joins us in studio. He's a Democratic nominee for the Montgomery County Council. He's running to represent the county's 5th district. He's currently a member of the Maryland House of Delegates, whose district is located in Montgomery County. Delegate Hucker, thank you for joining us.
Thanks for having me, Kojo.
You've been a member of the Maryland House of Delegates since 2007, but this year threw your lot in the race for the Montgomery County Council and won a seat in the Democratic primary in June. Why leave the state house for county government?
Nobody's ever asked me that before.
Yeah, right.
Well, it was a really hard decision, honestly, Kojo. I really love the General Assembly. I'm proud of the work I've been able to do there. I'm going to miss it tremendously. But I didn't expect there to be a vacancy in the district that I've been representing. It very much overlaps the council district that I will hopefully represent. And I was really persuaded by a whole lot of phone calls I got after the seat became vacant from a lot of friends and supporters urging me to get in the race because they wanted to see somebody experienced representing us in Rockville on the county council, because our district has the greatest needs for county services, the greatest amount of poor families, immigrants, families with special needs, and they wanted to see somebody experienced that knows the legislative process and has been successful in that kind of environment to represent us on the county council.
Can I assume they also wanted to see somebody they considered progressive, because you used to be the executive director for Progressive Maryland. Your predecessor in this job, Valerie Irvin, left to work for another organization considered progressive, the Working Families Party. She's going to become executive director of the Center for Working Families. But here's what she said, that whoever replaced her should reflect the diversity in the district. That she was the first African-American woman to serve on the council, and she called her seat a legacy seat. What that says to me is that she wanted an African-American to replace her. How do you react to that?
Well, Valerie and I have been friends for a long time, and she was very encouraging when we first started talking about this possibility. Ultimately, this is why we have elections. We leave these decisions up to the voters, not to pundits, not to politicians. I'm glad we had a very diverse group of candidates. We had a very vigorous debate. We had probably 15 public forums. We debated every issue under the sun. And, ultimately, I'm glad that I was able to prevail. And I wouldn't have prevailed unless I had support from the top of the district up in Burtonsville all the way down to Tacoma Park and from every community in the district. Those are the folks that have elected me twice to the General Assembly, and those are the folks that allowed me to prevail in the primary.
Did you get asked in every forum why you wanted to leave the State House to run for?
Pretty much, yeah.
You raised
that question I asked from the rebroadcast.
Well, and I did have a lot of people, and I still have a lot of people coming up to me on the street, perfect strangers, saying, "I'm so glad you did. I'm really glad you got in this race."
Did you
want
to do
this,
or did you answer? You were casting this. You were called to do this, a draft. But I mean, you wanted to do this, and people endorsed it. It's not like you weren't thinking about it and somebody came and said, hey, let's run for the council instead.
Well, I wasn't thinking about it. I had considered the council many years ago and thought that wasn't the right fit for me. And I had been, like you mentioned, a public interest advocate in Annapolis for many years, 6 years before I was elected.
Well, let's get on with the question. You don't have a Republican opposition.
I don't, no.
Okay, do you have any opposition, write-in, libertarian, D.C. statehood?
I don't, no.
Okay. Bill Turk of the Washington Post. Kojo just loves it when I mention Bill Turk.
Terrible Turk.
Terrible Turk. Mm-hmm. I said, what should I ask him? He covers Montgomery County for the Washington Post. And he writes to me, Bill Turk says, the schools in your district are the worst in the county. Heavy population of high need and low income minority students. Council President Craig Rice suggested that maybe the Board of Education should look at boundary changes to ease the socioeconomic isolation of these students. What do you think?
About boundary changes in particular?
Boundary changes, yes. Using socioeconomic issues rather than populations.
Just to start at the beginning.
If you would talk directly
people,
to
me,
if you say something new.
Many of your listeners are familiar probably with the don't bet on me saying anything newsworthy, but
we make those decisions.
With the recent report that came out of the County Council, the Office of Legislative Oversight, that showed the achievement gap between of-color students and our poorer students and our white and Asian students is growing dramatically over the last three years, and that we had been making progress on closing this, and that the last 3 years we've seen it get worse under the new superintendent. So the question is, what do we do about it? And there are many recommendations outlined in that report, starting with, more services for students of special needs and our at-risk students in our high schools, more identification of students that are falling into destructive behaviors in middle school, where there's more suspension than any other time. And I personally believe we need a lot more investment in pre-K and early education to get ahead of the curve. But yeah, I think we need to look at every tool in the toolbox, including boundary changes. That doesn't mean every boundary change is a good idea.
Based on socioeconomic issues, not just where people are in general.
Yeah, the boundaries that exist now were drawn by elected officials to meet the needs of the county back then, and we should continue to consider them. As Councilmember Branson said in that same hearing, we look at boundary changes all the time for legislative districts and in all kinds of service districts. There's no reason that the school board shouldn't be looking at those for the school districts.
So a boundary would say, well, we've got these many poor people over here and these many moderate or well-to-do people over here. Let's put them all together so there'll be socioeconomic integration of the school.
Well, and you also obviously look at that for population as well. I mean, our side of the county is growing really dramatically. And the county as a whole has 2,000 new students coming in every year. We're growing faster than any other county. We need more school construction money from the state. But we've also, I think, not done a good job of predicting how quickly our schools will grow. And people have suggested there's political reasons involved, but making our schools smaller than they need to be so we can brag about the number of new schools we're building when, in fact, every year or two after the new school gets opened, it's overcrowded. So, I think we need to really look at all the population estimates, where the demographic trends are, and use every tool in our toolbox, and I don't think anything is sacred.
Here is Scott in Washington, D.C. Please don your headphones, Tom and Tom Hooker. Yeah, we both have two Toms in the studio at this point. Scott, you're on the air. Go ahead, please.
Hi. Thanks, Kojo. I appreciate your show. And Tom, I just wanted to say I really appreciate the work you did in the legislature. It was very, you know, amazing the kind of stuff you accomplished. And looking forward to getting on the council. And I was wondering what you could say about your legislative priorities. Like, what are your top, say, three things that you want to try and accomplish with the council?
In 10 seconds or less.
Right. Well, Scott, thanks for your comment. Can you hear me?
I thought he was complimenting me. He said Tom.
He might have been.
And I got an email from Tom, but go ahead.
First, is number one is just I want to do strong constituent service. As I said, our district is in more need of it than any other district and has more poor families, more immigrant families. I think job number one at the council level is making sure to connect my constituents with the services that they deserve. Number two is I really want to work, as I mentioned, on expanding early education. I was able to pass four bills through the General Assembly to dramatically expand early education in Maryland, including one that brought in $50 million in a federal grant to expand it in Maryland. Unfortunately, Montgomery County has fallen behind a lot of neighboring jurisdictions. I've talked to Mayor Gray about this. D.C. is now leading the country in the number of three-year-olds and four-year-olds getting into high-quality early education. There's no reason Montgomery County should be falling behind D.C. or any counties in Maryland. That's really the way long-term we're going to close the achievement gap. And I guess if I to pick a third, there's plenty of transportation challenges on the horizon to improve our transportation system, both the things that we have now like Metro and Ride-On, and to get bus rapid transit moving as well.
Well, Tom, who wrote this email, would like to address another issue. Legislation, he writes, was recently introduced to ban the box, which prohibits employers from asking about criminal histories before making an offer of employment. What is your position on this proposal?
Well, you know, the Maryland government is a large employer, and we practice ban the box, and I voted for that bill. So we, before we make an offer of employment, we don't ask people whether they had an arrest or conviction history. And it has not had any bad effects on Maryland as an employer and our ability to find and retain quality employees. So I am glad that Councilmember Elrich and Councilwoman Branson introduced this bill in the Montgomery County Council. I went to their press conference to be with them when they did, and I hope the bill passes.
Sure.
Why is it relevant? Why is it unfair for a private business to ask somebody of their background, well, tell me about yourself. Are you married? Are you not? Mm-hmm. Do you have kids? Do whatever. Then have you ever been imprisoned?
Right.
Why is it wrong?
No, that's the right question. It's fine for them to ask about background. It is wrong, I think, for large employers especially to rule out an entire class of applicants. What we see on in Walmart and many very large employers' application is a box like that. And when the application gets completed, the applications go into two piles: one that where you say yes, and one where it says no. And if you've ever been arrested, even if it's for having a joint in your car 12 years ago,
you don't even get an interview.
They go right in the trash can because you have plenty of other applicants.
Is it restricted to a certain size company and above, or is it for any company? Is it any business in the LLC?
The bill's only been introduced, and I'm sure it'll be amended quite a bit, but I don't think it has
like 10 or 20 or 30?
I haven't looked at that level of detail.
Okay.
Here we move on to Annabel in Rockville, Maryland. Annabel, you're on the air. Go ahead, please.
Oh, hi. My question is, you were in the legislature for 8 years. What was the accomplishment you were most proud of?
Well, I'm very proud overall of there's several first in the nation bills that I was able to pass and get the governor to sign. One was a living wage law. David Catania just mentioned the living wage law that he championed in D.C. When he did, he reached out to me at that time because I had been the sponsor of the Maryland living wage law that required all the contract employees with the state of Maryland to be paid enough to feed their family without requiring food stamps or public assistance. That lifted tens of thousands of families out of poverty. I'm very proud of that, as I am of other public health legislation to get arsenic out of chicken in our environment, which was widely added, strangely, as an antibiotic to all the chickens in Maryland and really all the chickens in the country for about 60 years before we banned it.
What's your biggest disappointment, having served in the legislature and having to deal with the legislative comings and goings? What's the biggest, I don't call it a failure, but disappointment?
I don't know if it's a disappointment, but it's a constant sort of frustration. Is the structure, I think, is a bit anachronistic. You know, we operate in the General Assembly. We're highly efficient compared to any of the county or city councils. We consider 2,300 bills a year. When I say a year, that's in just a 90-day legislative mm-hmm. session. So we have to consider an immense range of complicated topics and make a decision up or down very, very quickly. And, most topics don't lend themselves to that pace. So many bills that would do people a lot of good take two or three or 4 years to pass. And I don't think they would if we went year-round. We have problems to address year-round. I think we'd be better off if we went year-round.
In Montgomery County, there was a big to-do over whether the police union representing the police could interfere, or they would say have a part in changes in the rules. And they still would like to see that reversed so that they could bargain with the chief, county police chief. Do you have any views on that?
On effects bargaining?
Means that the Montgomery County police get a chance to bargain on some kinds of management positions.
Sure.
The police.
Although the county contended it bollocked every management decision the chief tried to make, and that's why they got rid of it. But what's your view on that? Because that might come up again.
Well, I don't think it will come up again, Tom. It's really a dead issue, and I've talked to the police union too, and they believe it's a dead issue.
Okay,
they're not going to raise it again.
Remember,
it went before the voters, and there were questions raised about public spending on the election.
Let's talk about teachers union.
But it's settled. Sure.
Let's talk about teachers union.
Sure. I think it's a settled issue.
Are they supporting you, the teachers union?
They didn't make an endorsement in District 5. They were in a strange position. One of my opponents was on the school board, still is on the school board now after he lost in the primary.
The Washington Post editorially has been complaining that teachers have too much power.
I know the argument. I don't think the evidence really bears that out. I mean, the unions in Montgomery County are weaker than they've been in many years. I am glad to have the support of many of them, just like I had the support of all the environmental groups and all the women's groups and all the immigrant groups, because I had worked
with
many of them for years.
You've been endorsed by everybody.
Glad you mentioned immigrant groups, because Governor Martin O'Malley has been in the middle of one of the more divisive political debates in the country recently as to what to do about the flood of immigrant children coming into American communities, undocumented children. It's my understanding you attended a meeting earlier this week that he put together with faith leaders. He suggested that finding foster homes for the children living in Maryland, not large centers like the federal government has suggested, would be the best way forward. How would you see it for Montgomery County?
Well, I think he's right. I told the governor that I was pleased to hear the comments he made at the National Governors Association that this is a humanitarian crisis and that we ought to figure out how to deal with this crisis as Americans in consistency with the best traditions we've had, rather than just putting them in a kennel and figuring out how we can deport them as quickly as possible. I am glad he has said that Maryland is willing to take our fair share of these kids. Many of them will be coming to Montgomery County in particular because they have family members here. And he, I think was unfairly impugned because he said Westminster, of course, is you couldn't find a worse place in Maryland to put these kids. Even if it was a welcoming community, there's no services or transportation they could access there. Many of these kids will be coming to Montgomery and Prince George's County, and I think we need to, our first responsibility is to our current residents and to the kids that will be coming here, but I think we need to step up and say we're a welcoming and wealthy community, and we're going to respond to this humanitarian crisis like our best traditions call us.
And I'm afraid that's about all the time we have. Tom Hucker, he's Democratic nominee for the Montgomery County Council, running to represent the county's 5th district, currently a member of the Maryland House of Delegates, whose district is located in Montgomery County. And so you don't have any opposition as yet in the general election?
You could announce your write-in candidacy right now to go jump in.
Well, I was about to say, why would I even bother to wish you good luck then?
You don't need to.
Thank you very much. I'll accept your good luck anyway.
Tom
Sherwood is our resident analyst. He's an NBC4 reporter and a columnist for the current newspapers. Have a great weekend, Tom.
In Virginia, I'm going through the D.C. flag atop my car.
Thank you all for listening. I'm Kojo Namdi. Coming up Monday on the Kojo Namdi Show, Howard University's new president. The historically black college faces financial and philosophical challenges as Wayne Frederick takes the helm. Then at 1, diversity by the numbers. News and entertainment companies say they want a variety of perspectives and faces, why they don't always meet the mark. The Kojo Namdi Show, noon till 2 Monday on WAMU 88.5 and streaming at kojoshow.org.
Good afternoon. I'm Jessica Jordan. You're listening to WAMU.
Thanks for listening to the Kojo Namdi Show. And if you're already a member of WAMU 88.5, thank you for your support. If not, it's easy to give online at wamu.org. Just click the donate button, and thanks.